From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, antidepressants, how they work, how they were developed, and how they may be improved in the future. We talk with Dr. Samuel Berendez, author of Better Than Prozac. Berendez is director of the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. Also, singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash tells us about her 2.5-year hiatus from singing, the recent death of her stepmother, June Carter Cash, and her new album, Rules of Travel. It features a duet with her father, Johnny Cash. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. A divided Supreme Court has ruled that colleges and universities may consider race in college admissions, but that race may not be the overriding factor. By a vote of 5-4, the justices upheld a University of Michigan law school policy based on affirmative action, but it struck down the university's undergraduate policy, which used a point system. Courtney Skiles is a representative of the University of Michigan Student Assembly. She says even though the university will have to modify its undergraduate policy, affirmative action there will continue.
We are thrilled that the Supreme Court has decided to uphold the importance of racial and ethnic diversity in our classrooms and the use of race-conscious admissions. We also expect our university to maintain or increase the enrollment of students of color.
Patrick Hamaker was one of the plaintiffs who challenged the University of Michigan's policies. He sees today's decision as a blow to affirmative action.
I'm delighted by the undergraduate decision. However, I'm baffled that the Supreme Court didn't see the same principle at work in the law school. I think it's pretty obvious, though, that the writing is on the wall, and day by day, racial preferences are coming to an end in America.
In another ruling, the justices said that Congress can force the nation's libraries to equip computers with filters to keep out pornography. By a vote of 6-3, the court ruled that the filters do not violate the First Amendment, even though they may keep out some legitimate informational websites. President Bush has designated a Qatari national as an enemy combatant and transferred him from the criminal court system in New York to military custody. Justice Department officials accuse Ali Salah Al-Mari of being an al-Qaeda operative, NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Al-Mari was detained back in December 2001 as a material witness. A grand jury later indicted him on credit card fraud in an alleged scam to finance al-Qaeda activities. But in recent months, Justice Department officials say they received intelligence from other al-Qaeda detainees that Al-Mari was a sleeper operative. They say he allegedly attended the Al-Farouq training camp in Afghanistan, pledged his service to Osama bin Laden, and volunteered to be a martyr. They say there's no indication that he took part in or even knew about the 9/11 attacks. Justice officials say it was decided that holding a trial for Al-Mari could harm national security, though they declined to specify how. The criminal charges against him have been dropped. He may eventually face trial by a military tribunal. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks were lowered today. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials closed down 128 points to 9,072. Trading was active 1.3 billion shares. The NASDAQ down 34 to 1610. The S&P down 14 to 981. This is NPR News. Residents of Deschler, Nebraska began cleaning up today from devastating storms that struck their small town last night. From Nebraska Public Radio, Fred Knapp reports.
Deschler was without water, power, or gas service Monday following tornadoes, flooding, and hailstorms the night before. One person died, four homes were destroyed, and dozens of houses and businesses were damaged. High school English teacher Carol Good was one of many area residents helping salvage belongings for a neighbor whose house was destroyed.
I feel bad for everybody that, and Lucky too, but everybody that had damage done. I mean, there's a lot of people to help, but you know, you can't bring it all back. It's gone.
Nebraska Governor Mike Johanns toured the town Monday and declared the county a disaster area. For NPR News, I'm Fred Knapp in Lincoln, Nebraska.
In Arizona, the Aspen Fire has now burned more than 12,000 acres on a mountain near Tucson. It's about 5% contained, but high temperatures, low humidity, and gusting winds continue to hamper efforts to fight it. Officials don't know how it started. Jeff Whitney, the incident commander, says investigators haven't been able to get to the point of origin.
The fire is still too active between any of the control lines and what we believe to be the location of the start. We're going to do some things tomorrow to get in on the ground, and that's when the actual investigation will be done.
Today, firefighters have been concentrating on building fire lines to stop the fire from spreading. They've used bulldozers to help them do that. The fire has destroyed 250 homes. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Computer Associates, offering Flex Select licensing. Our software sold your way. On the web at ca.com/flexselect.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 35 million Americans suffer from depression severe enough to warrant treatment at some time in their lives, according to a study that was released last week, sponsored by the National Institutes of Health. The study also found that 60% of the people who seek treatment for their depression don't receive adequate care. My guest, Dr. Samuel Berendez, is the director of the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. His new book is about antidepressants, how they were created, how they work, and how they may be improved in the future. The book is called Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. Dr. Berendez is also the author of a previous book about the genetic links to mood disorders. You point out in your book that not all drugs work for all patients. And about one out of three people with major depressions don't get much benefit from the first antidepressant that they're given. Why is there such variation?
We don't know. I think that's one of the real puzzles about this disorder. One can speculate that different people have different underlying biochemical abnormalities, and so that different drugs might control them differently. But the answer in simple is that we really don't know. The fact, though, is that some people won't respond to one drug and will then respond to another. And we don't really understand why that happens.
So you're often in the position of trying one drug for a few weeks or a few months and then changing it until you get results.
That's right. There's a lot of trial and error in the treatment of this disorder, although a lot of people respond to the standard drugs very well, so that it's not completely haphazard. But if one drug doesn't work, the experience says, don't give up, try another one.
Often with antidepressants, you need to take them for a period of weeks before you get any positive effect, if in fact you're going to get a positive effect. Why does it take so long for the antidepressants to begin working?
That's one of the great mysteries about these medications. We have a general answer for this, which says that it takes a while for the brain to adapt to the changes in its chemistry which the drug produces. Because the drug does produce chemistry changes very promptly. That is, Prozac, for example, changes the way that the brain deals with serotonin very quickly. But then over the course of weeks, the brain adapts to this disturbance, to this change in its chemistry, and that presumably is where the therapeutic effect comes from. But that's just speaking in great generalities. The reality is that we don't know the specifics of this therapeutic effect, and finding out those specifics would be enormously valuable in making for better treatments for this disorder.
Now, you say that, you know, originally doctors believed that drugs should be prescribed only for disabling depressions.
Yes.
How much has that changed? It seems to me a lot of people who don't exactly have disabling depressions are still taking antidepressants.
It's changed a great deal. It used to be that only people who were suicidal or were just so completely depressed and incapacitated were treated with medications. The notion was, in the 60s, for example, that everybody else should be treated exclusively with psychotherapy, and that tampering with people's brain chemicals was something that should be avoided at all cost. Over the years, and particularly as drugs with lesser side effects were developed, Prozac being the most stunning example, although it's certainly not free of side effects, as drugs with lesser side effects, which people were more willing to take without complaints were developed. The severity kept going down so that now people with mild to moderate depression are frequently treated and frequently with considerable benefit by these psychiatric drugs.
What are the side effects that cause your patients the most trouble?
Well, initially people complain of nausea sometimes, difficulty sleeping sometimes, even increased nervousness sometimes. It varies from person to person. Over longer periods of time, the most common complaint is some sort of sexual dysfunction. A significant, but by no means all people, a significant percentage of people complain of either some loss of interest in sex or sexual incapacities of various kinds.
This is men and women?
Men and women, yes.
And does their sexual feelings return when they stop taking the drugs, or is
yes.
this a more permanent side effect?
No, it's not a permanent side effect. It is reversible if the drug is stopped.
Do you ever see cases where you think somebody has changed too extremely, that they're no longer themselves?
Well, I think that that does happen. And in fact, there can even be very distressing changes in people. In people who have a propensity to not only have depression, but manic episodes, some people who take these medications can actually become manic, can become irresponsible, can start spending money all the time, can start being hypersexual. In that sense, can be no longer themselves. Of course, what a self is not a constant matter. We all are somewhat different selves in the course of the day and in the course of our lifetimes. We have a large repertoire of behaviors, but these drugs can push one in certain directions, and sometimes that result is extremely pleasing or relieving to people, but in other circumstances, it can be quite distressing, actually.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Samuel Berendez. He's the author of the book Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. He's the director of the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. Antidepressants are pretty new. Before the 1950s, what we had mostly was sedatives like phenobarbital. What did the sedatives do and what were they prescribed for? What kind of psychological problems were they prescribed for?
Phenobarbital was used for everything in the 30s and 40s. It was sort of the wonder drug of the time. So whatever ailed you, whether you were nervous or depressed or psychotic, phenobarbital was a very common medication. And there were lots of people taking elixir of phenobarbital or pills, phenobarbital pills. It was an extremely widely used, one-size-fits-all medication for mental distress. And family doctors were amongst the biggest prescribers. So it was sort of the drug that one used whenever anybody complained about some sort of problem.
Like what kind of problems?
Well, like being nervous or like being tired or like being worried, like staying up all night and worrying, which can be a symptom of depression, or like being reluctant to go to work. That is, whatever bothered you, the medicine that was most readily available to family doctors was phenobarbital. Psychiatrists, of course, were extremely reluctant to use phenobarbital except as a sleeping medication because they, in that period, believed that the great treatment for whatever ails you is psychotherapy. So that there was a real split in the way that the medical profession was organized.
Now, how do the antidepressants of today, you know, the Prozac type of drugs,
yes.
relate to the earlier antipsychotics and anti-anxiety drugs?
Well, the interesting thing about the antidepressants is that they, or the ones that we use today, is that they can trace their origins to the desire by a pharmaceutical company to make a drug as a competitor for the phenothiazines like Thorazine, Chlorpromazine. So the story goes this way. Thorazine was originally designed as an antihistamine, as a cold remedy, and it was only by chance that it was discovered to be useful in the treatment of psychosis. And so as soon as that was discovered and as soon as Thorazine became an enormously popular and profitable drug, other pharmaceutical companies became interested in copying it. And so a company named Geigy in Switzerland looked in its storehouse and found a a drug that looked very much like chlorpromazine called imipramine. And so they sent it to psychiatrists and said, try this out. Maybe we too can gain a large share of the market for this important new medication. But amazingly enough, it did not work on psychosis or schizophrenia. It did, however, also amazingly, relieve depression. And so out of the desire to make a me-too drug for the treatment of schizophrenia came imipramine, which is the progenitor of most of the antidepressants that are used right now, including Prozac.
How does it work?
It was an accidental. How does it work? Okay. Well, we know a little bit of how it works. We know that when imipramine is given to people, that it increases the effectiveness of certain brain chemicals, namely the chemicals called serotonin and norepinephrine, which are normally present in our brains and which we normally use to communicate all kinds of signals, many of them of an emotional content. So when you take that original drug, imipramine, what happens is that norepinephrine and serotonin hang around longer, work more effectively in the brain. Once that was discovered, the pharmaceutical companies started looking around to see if they could perhaps try drugs which affected one or the other. And the driving force in that instance was to reduce side effects. That is, the more specific the drug, that is, the more specific its effect on individual brain chemicals, the better it might be. And in the quest to find a drug that was very specific for serotonin, the Lilly company discovered Prozac.
I guess I don't feel like I really understand what serotonin does in the brain.
Right. Well, it does an enormous number of things. Serotonin is one of these chemicals that controls a variety of behaviors. And it does this by affecting 14 different receptors that are scattered throughout the brain, which means that its effects are enormously complicated. Lots of chemicals affect only one receptor located in one specific place. Serotonin spreads out all over the brain, that is released from the terminals of nerve cells all over the brain, submits signals to various nerve cells that are scattered hither and yon that have different receptors, all of which respond to serotonin. And the net effect of all this serotonin output can be enormously complicated. And when you take Prozac, you augment all those effects. And amazingly enough, the outcome of this great change in the brain chemistry is therapeutic, especially over the course of weeks, as you pointed out before. So in very well-controlled clinical studies, the drug has been shown to be effective and helpful for a large number of people, although not without some side effects.
My guest is Dr. Samuel Berendez, author of Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dr. Samuel Berendez. He's the author of the new book, Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. He's the director of the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. Medicine is still in its like early stages of understanding brain chemistry. Does it make you nervous as a doctor to prescribe drugs when scientists still know so little about how they work, and scientists know so little about the chemicals within the brain?
Yes, it does. But this is true not only of psychiatry; it's true of all of medicine. You may recall that the wonder drug that's in everybody's medicine cabinet, aspirin, which was discovered by chance in the latter part of the 19th century, was a completely mysterious drug until its mechanism of action on the body was discovered in the 1970s. So that for 70 years or so, people were taking aspirin by the bucketful, and doctors were prescribing it glibly, and people were prescribing it themselves. That is, were going to the local drugstore and buying the stuff. And nobody really understood how it worked. I mean, much of pharmacology is based on observations which in recent years are supported by carefully controlled clinical trials, that it works and that the benefit exceeds the downside. But taking a complicated chemical and putting it into the body does all kinds of things, and figuring out all of them is really extremely difficult. So this is the state of the art in medicine, in psychiatry, but also in medicine in general. Now, there are some exceptions. There are some drugs that we understand rather well, but much of pharmacology, even today, even in this modern era that we are so proud of, much of these, many of these medications work in poorly understood ways. So psychiatry is not at all exceptional in that regard.
You write in your book, Better Than Prozac, that pharmaceutical companies are focusing on improving the current antidepressant and anti-anxiety drugs as opposed to finding new ones. Why is that?
Well, I think they are trying to do both, but improving the current ones is a much surer thing. That is to say, once a market for a specific kind of drug is established, if you can just tweak it a little bit and get slightly better side effects or slightly more efficacy, you can gain huge market share, and doctors will be eager to prescribe the new variant if there's reasonable evidence that it's better, without the reluctance that might come from trying a new medication. It's also really hard to find something new. Remember, the Prozac-like drugs came from tweaking imipramine, which was discovered by accident. It was an antihistamine. Finding really new classes of drugs is extraordinarily difficult, and so pharmaceutical companies are very inclined to make big investments in getting something that's a little bit better than what's already out there, and are worried about trying to find something completely new, A, because it might be more difficult to market, but more importantly, because it might be very difficult to find something from scratch that's really new and that really works. On the other hand, in instances where that happens, they've got a new blockbuster on their hands.
You think that the next frontier for antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs will be genetic-oriented drugs. What are some of the possibilities for the future?
Yes. I think in the long term, genetics is going to help us enormously in understanding why certain people are prone to become depressed, whereas others in the same life circumstance go on their merry way. That is, there is clearly a difference amongst people in their propensity for depression or anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder or schizophrenia or whatever psychiatric disorder you may think of. In each case, there's clear evidence that there's some familial component to this, that it runs somewhat in families, and that there's some genetic variation that makes people vulnerable to the particular condition. So now that we know so much about the human genome, and now that we're in a position to learn more about the genetic variations that each person has, a huge effort is being exerted to find out why certain people are prone to the various psychological ailments, just as a huge effort is being put out to find out why people are more prone to develop diabetes or high blood pressure or whatever. Just as those diseases have genetic underpinnings, so too do all the psychiatric diseases, including the lesser ones like moodiness, etc. So in the end, as we learn more about genetic variations amongst people, we will be in a position to learn what the circuits, what the genetic circuits in people's brains are like, as well as the genetic circuits in their bodies, and how they make these vulnerabilities exist. And that, in turn, will lead to the development of new specific medications for people who have specific kinds of genetic vulnerabilities.
This is going to be a difficult question to answer because it's so broad, but when a patient, when you're seeing a patient for the first time, what criteria do you use to decide whether the person should receive medication or not?
Well, assessing a person is a complicated thing. My inclination when seeing people is to assess their strengths and weaknesses and not intervene at all if it's not necessary. That is, I don't assume when I see a person that they need either psychotherapy or pharmacological therapy. My hope is that a small amount of conversation is all that's necessary to have them reoriented and get on their way. I don't sit there expecting that this person has a brain chemical problem that I've got to fix, or this person has a deep-seated psychological problem that I've got to fix. I hear out what the problem is and then try to respond accordingly.
Dr. Berendez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Dr. Samuel Berendez is the author of Better Than Prozac, Creating the Next Generation of Psychiatric Drugs. He directs the Center for Neurobiology and Psychiatry at the University of California in San Francisco. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Remind Me Again Why I Married You, a novel of love and marriage by Rita Cerisi, author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash performs a duet with her father, Johnny Cash, on her latest CD, Rules of Travel. Coming up, we talk with Roseanne Cash about the CD, why she couldn't sing for 2 years, her anti-war stance and her fans' response, and the recent death of her stepmother, June Carter Cash. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Roseanne Cash recently released her comeback CD after losing her voice for 2.5 years as a result of a polyp on her vocal cord. It's called Rules of Travel. Our rock critic Ken Tucker describes it as first-rate music. Rules of Travel is Cash's first album of new material in 10 years. During that time, she got married, had a baby, wrote a book of short stories, and a children's book. The CD features duets with Steve Earle and Jacob Dylan, as well as this track, Beautiful Pain, with Sheryl Crow.
Do you want to be honest? Do you want to win? You could have it all if you could gracefully give in. Like when a martyr knows he's a martyr, and looking in the mirror makes you cry harder about your glitter and ball and chain. In love.
Roseanne Cash with Sheryl Crow from Cash's new CD, Rules of Travel. The CD also features a duet with Roseanne Cash's father, Johnny Cash, on the song September When It Comes. I asked Roseanne if she wrote the song with her father in mind.
No, I didn't, although he was indirectly the inspiration for the song because he got ill, very ill, about 10 years ago for the first time, and that first glimpse of parents' mortality, you know, it's a bit of a shake-up. And just the train of thought that it propelled me on, you know, my own mortality, the unresolved issues with my parents, all of that was kind of up for me. So I wrote this song, and not intending to have him sing on it at all. And in fact, I recorded it by myself.
So how did your father end up duetting with you?
My husband, John Leventhal, who produced this record, after it was finished, you know, after we had recorded it, he said, you really should ask your dad to sing on this, you know, we'll overdub him and put him on. And I resisted for the first few months that he kept bringing it up. He brought it up several times. I said, no, I don't want to invite people, you know, to think that I'm using him or that it's a novelty because the song is too important. And John finally said, exactly, the song is too important. It's the right song. It's the right time. You should do this. So I asked my dad, and he said, I said, Dad, I have this song I'd love for you to sing on. He said, well, I'll have to read the lyrics first.
Well, you know, I think that's interesting. He didn't want to hear the music. He wanted to read the lyrics. Why were the lyrics more important than the music?
Well, he wanted to make sure that what he was saying was something that was authentic to him. So when I took the tape down there and he read the lyrics, he said, yes, I can do this.
Did he say anything else about the lyrics?
Not then. It was so obvious, you know. He's not one to belabor a point, and he's also not one to over-sentimentalize things. And he has kind of a ruthless vision of the truth. So, you know, he knew what the song was about, and he knew it was the right time for us to do this. He told me, actually not long ago, he said, I'm really proud of the song in the context of the whole record. And that meant more to me than if he had just said, I'm really proud of the song.
I really like the way you both sound on it. You really hear the vulnerability in his voice on this song. And, of course, the song is about vulnerability and aging.
Right.
At least it's in part about that.
Yeah.
How does he feel, do you know, about the age and weakness that you hear in his voice now?
He hears it as a kind of less than he could do professionally. He said, oh, I could have sung that better. You know, I don't think he hears himself and thinks, oh, I sound aged and infirm. he just thinks, oh, my voice isn't the best it could be. Because, you know, truth is he does go in cycles, and the next recording he made of his own recording, his voice was very strong again. You know, it does go in cycles for him, his health.
Was he able to record his part in the studio?
Yeah, but in his own studio. I took it down to Nashville, and he has a studio in the woods. It's a really sweet little cabin in the woods. It's a studio near his house, and that's where we recorded it. It was a very sweet day. It was just me and him and my brother who did the recording.
Let's listen to Johnny Cash and Roseanne Cash singing September When It Comes from Roseanne Cash's latest CD, Rules of Travel.
I plan to crawl outside these walls, close my eyes and see, and fall into the heart and arms of those who wait for me. I cannot move a mountain now, I can no longer run, I cannot be who I was then. In a way, I never was.
Watch the clouds go sailing. Watch the clock and sun. Oh, I watch myself depending on September. When it comes.
Your father is very vulnerable now. He's been sick with, I'm not sure exactly what the illness is. Go ahead.
Autonomic neuropathy. It's and he's diabetic, and that they're related.
So what is autonomic neuropathy?
Well, it's a degenerative nerve disease.
Does that mean he's in a lot of pain?
If he is, he doesn't say so. Mm-hmm. He's an incredibly stoic person, and he's of that generation that believes that you do your suffering in silence, and that it's, you know, there's a certain nobility and honor in not complaining. You know, I'm certainly not of that generation.
You know, your father, who's such an image of strength, is very vulnerable now. Your stepmother, June Carter, died last month. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're at that stage in life where you're watching parents become vulnerable or pass away, and it's something that so many people in their 40s and 50s are going through now.
Well, I would say 90% of my friends are going through the same thing. It's, you know, it's kind of startling. You realize, oh, this is a developmental stage or something. Everybody goes through this. You know, you don't think about it when you're younger. But it does, it really rearranges everything, your priorities. It's really changed what I've held on to that I didn't have to be holding on to. You know that saying that after the age of 25, it's unseemly to blame your parents for your life? I would have to agree with that.
My guest is Roseanne Cash. Her latest CD is called Rules of Travel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer and songwriter Roseanne Cash. Her latest CD is called Rules of Travel. When we left off, we were talking about her father, Johnny Cash, and the recent death of her stepmother, June Carter Cash. Were you very close with June Carter?
I was very close with June. I always said that my mother gave me structure and June gave me wings, and both were essential for my life. And I would not have become a performer had it not been for June.
Why not? What did she do that encouraged you?
Well, it wasn't overt. It was just being around her and being on the road with her for a few years, actually, and seeing, you know, she had been on the road virtually her entire life. She had been a performer since she was a preteen. And she had a naturalness about it, and she just incorporated being in front of an audience and performing and singing and playing music, she incorporated it into her life. It wasn't separate. She didn't change personalities when she was backstage from, and then when she walked on stage. It was all the same. And that kind of natural affinity for it made me rethink it, because, you know, as a child, I thought, well, being a performer is just the worst thing you could possibly do. It invites fame, and that's the worst thing that could happen to you. Because from my point of view as a child, you know, it destroyed your family, and it made you take substances to stay awake, and it was exhausting, and, you know, the whole thing. So to see June, the way she did it was, I rethought it. You know, I thought, well, this might not be such a bad life after all.
You said that she was the same person on stage as off. And
she was.
What about your father? Is he different on stage?
No, he's the same guy, too. In fact, he's more himself on stage. It's interesting. Any distractions fall away once he's under the lights. He becomes very focused. He becomes kind of his essential self. He becomes timeless when he's on stage.
Can you share some memories from when you started performing with Johnny Cash and June Carter? And I think this was like after you graduated from high school?
Yeah, that was when I went on the road with him after high school. It was a way to see the world. I wasn't interested in being a singer or a performer. I just wanted to be with my dad and travel, and, you know, that's what that was about. It was later that I kind of grew into that life.
So what were you doing on the tour when you weren't really interested in performing?
I was, I think they put me down as laundress on the on the manifest so that they could write me off their taxes. So I do remember washing out some black pants in a bathtub a couple of times, but that was about the extent of it. But I was, you know, I was traveling. I was doing what they did. I was learning how to order in really great restaurants and find the best hotels. And, you know, it was a great life, a wonderful life for a young girl.
Were there certain generational differences that you realize existed between between you and Johnny Cash and June Carter, things that affected you personally but also as a performer?
Yes. Well, it was different partly and in a very large part because of their upbringings, which were very different from mine. You know, I was raised in Southern California. I grew up on rock and roll. I was profoundly imprinted by the Beatles. And, you know, I was modern, kind of semi-urban girl. And they both grew up in very rural surroundings. My dad in Arkansas in cotton fields, and June in Appalachia. So their lives were transformed by becoming performers and by becoming public people. And but they have that kind of very old world notion about it, that the fans are part of their life and they're very accepting. And I have never once in my entire life seen June or my dad be rude to a fan who came up to them, no matter how, you know, disturbing it was or how unwelcome it was. They're unfailingly polite. And so that, you know, just the upbringing was very different. That provided a generational difference, a huge one. And I don't exactly feel that way. I mean, I like my private life. There are choices they've made about being public people that I would not have made.
Like what?
Well, June's funeral is the first thing that comes to mind, the fact of my dad wanting it to be public, you know. I mean, we all understood why, because their lives have been lived in public, because their fans are so much a part of their lives, because it's a very Southern thing to do for public people in the South. Me and my sisters and my brother were just, oh, you know, please, we just don't want to do this. But we totally respected and understood that. That would not have been a choice we would have made.
Let me play another song from your latest CD, Rules of Travel. Mm-hmm. And this is a song you wrote called I'll Change For You. Mm-hmm. And songwriter and singer Steve Earle duets with you on this. You want to say a few words about the song before we hear it?
Well, it was kind of I wrote the song as a kind of a nose thumb to this being therapeutically correct all the time in relationships, you know, this idea of, oh, no, you can't change for anyone. You must only change for yourself and blah. No one can make you happy, you know. I thought, well, that's not really the way the human heart works a lot of times. And, you know, it was a rebellion. And also, you know, I do love obsession, and I particularly love erotic obsession. So that's really what this song's about.
Okay, so this is Roseanne Cash's song, I'll Change For You, sung by Roseanne Cash and Steve Earle from her latest CD, Rules of Travel.
I'll change for you. I'll change for you. I'll change for you. I'll turn night into day.
Roseanne Cash with Steve Earle from Roseanne Cash's latest CD, Rules of Travel. Well, this is a record you almost didn't get to make because you had a polyp on your vocal cords that affected your talking and singing for, what, a couple of years?
2.5, going on 3 years, I lost my voice, right?
How much of it did you lose?
All of it. I sounded like Tom Waits with laryngitis. You know, some days I couldn't even speak. It was related to pregnancy. I got the polyps when I was 4 or 5 months pregnant, and we didn't know it was related to pregnancy. My doctor had not heard of that, and she did some research on it and found that it was possible. I was scheduled for surgery, and so she canceled it, and she said, I just want to wait and see what happens after you have the baby, after you stop nursing, once you're back to normal. And sure enough, about 6 months after I stopped nursing, the polyps went away.
So you couldn't sing and you could barely talk?
That's right.
What did you do to communicate?
Well, I would kind of squeak out, you know, this hoarse, this hoarse kind of froggy voice. And I definitely couldn't yell at my kids. That was very disturbing. But the most disturbing was I couldn't sing lullabies to this newborn. That was very sad.
But you probably just couldn't pass the time by talking to people who you liked either.
Yeah, it was torture to be on the phone. In fact, that's kind of been a holdover since I lost my voice, is I really don't like talking on the phone anymore.
Do you start to feel erased after a while? Because, I mean, part of what defines you is what you say to people. They don't even know what you think unless you tell them.
Well, that's very insightful, Terry. That's the right word, erased. I started to feel like I was nothing, that I was just not important, that I had no opinions because I couldn't express them, that I had no opinions, that I had no means of expression, that I didn't count in the world. I mean, I really had a full-blown identity crisis in the second year of losing my voice. The first year, I wasn't paying attention too much because I had a new baby. The second year, it was kind of a crisis.
Do you sing any differently than you did before?
I think I do sing differently, and I can't tell you exactly how. I feel less anxiety when I'm singing. I feel less of a need to monitor myself. You know, how's my pitch? Okay, how am I going to get to that note? Is this working? Is there some scratchiness there? You know, all of that kind of continual monitoring, which drives me crazy. I've let go of most of that.
Why? Why do you think you did?
Because I had this realization when I lost my voice that I had been taking for granted, and in fact, I'd kind of been abusing something that was really precious. And I thought to myself, if I get my voice back, I'm not going to take back the anxiety. I'm going to try to experience the joy of it. And I did. I feel like I did. And, you know, it was a classic thing of you don't realize what you have until you lose it. And I realized how important it was to me. The sense of loss was tremendous, so much greater than I imagined it would be when I couldn't sing.
So when you go out to perform on stage now, are you worried about whether your voice will be there, or are you confident that it will be?
No, sometimes I'm worried. You know, sometimes I go through, well, what if the polyp comes back? I mean, you know, I'm obsessive by nature, I told you. So I do go through it. But once I get out there, I can let go more than I used to be able to.
My guest is Roseanne Cash. Her latest CD is called Rules of Travel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer and songwriter Roseanne Cash. Her latest CD is called Rules of Travel. Now, I want to ask you about something else that's happened to you lately. Before the war in Iraq, you were part of this group, Musicians United to Win Without War.
Yeah.
And, you know, you made some public statements about why we shouldn't be going to war with Iraq. Now that the fighting part is over, at least most of the big fighting part is over, can you reflect on that experience a little bit of being, you know, a singer-songwriter making public statements about a political cause?
I've given a lot of thought to that because I got an enormous backlash from speaking out against going to war, you know. And
from who?
Just from, I don't know, just people sending emails to my website or writing me, you know. And it wasn't people saying in a very thoughtful manner, I disagree with you, and here's why. It was people saying, calling me every name in the book and being very abusive about it. And at first, I wrote some of them back, and I was respectful, and I said, well, here's why I believe this, and I've actually thought about this and tried to become well-informed about this, and here's why I think this. But it didn't work. You know, they didn't want to have a dialogue. And in fact, something really funny happened. My daughter, who's 21, she was the one who sorted through the email on my website, and she, you know, got a little scared because some of it was actually threatening. And I said, you know, Chelsea, do not write anybody back. If anyone will write back, it'll be me. Well, apparently one email was so abusive that she wrote back without my permission, and she said, if you ever talk to my mother like that again, I will hunt you down. I am not peaceful like she is.
So did they respond back to her email?
No, thank God. I had a model from my childhood about being an artist and being an activist, and it was my father. He spoke out against the Vietnam War, and it was not popular to do so. He took on the Ku Klux Klan. He was an advocate of Native American rights and prisoners' rights, you know, very unpopular subjects in the 60s. And he taught me that if you don't say what you believe, you're not worth your weight, you know. You have to say what you believe.
Did you run into, you know, like on a lot of radio stations, they banned the Dixie Chicks records because the Dixie Chicks spoke out against the war. Did you run into that on any radio stations that play your music?
No, radio stations don't play my music anyway, so that was not a problem.
Earlier you said that, you know, your father and June Carter were never rude to fans.
Never.
And you thought that was one of the generational differences. Were people rude to your father because of his stand on Vietnam, and how did he handle that?
Oh, my God. They burned a cross in our front yard when I was, 9, 10 years old. because he publicly took on the Ku Klux Klan. So yeah, it was beyond rudeness. I mean, he's had death threats. He's encountered all of it.
How did he handle that?
Oh, he has. I just can't tell you how unshakable he is, really. If he has a belief and a faith, then people could say anything to him. It really doesn't shake him.
Another question about your music. We talked a little bit about how your voice and your singing have changed since the polyp problem, the polyp on your vocal cord. Do you think your songwriting has been changed by the whole experience?
My songwriting has definitely been changed by this, and mainly because I didn't write any songs while I had lost my voice, and I started writing a lot of prose. And I wrote for New York Magazine, and I wrote for the New York Times Magazine, and Oxford American, and even Martha Stewart Living. I wrote a piece on lullabies, and lots of other periodicals, and I edited a book of songwriters' prose, and, you know, I was doing a lot of prose, and it changed me as a songwriter, definitely. It gave me a wider sandbox to play in a way.
In what way?
Well, you know, as a songwriter, you're bound to melody, you're bound to a rhyme scheme, you're bound to 3 or 4 minute format, you know, and usually because I'm a very structured person, I really love that. I love knowing the parameters and setting up the internal rules of each song and then just staying in that. It feels very safe and, you know, I have all the freedom within that box. But when writing prose, you know, it's a lot of rope to hang yourself with, but it's also a lot of freedom and relief. There's no rhyme. There's melody, but it's very subtle. You know, you can go on as long as you want. You don't have to stop after 3 minutes. So I brought some of that freedom back to songwriting, I think. At least it feels like I did.
Well, Roseanne Cash, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Roseanne Cash's latest CD is called Rules of Travel. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the director of one of the year's most talked about and controversial movies, the documentary Capturing the Freedmans. It's about a father and son accused of sexually abusing children and the impact of those charges on the family. The movie is also about the subjective nature of memory and the elusive nature of truth. Join us for the next Fresh Air.